The Naga of Lyon. My taxi overtook the camel shortly after we left Satalar Airport in southern France, but the animal caught up with us 10 minutes later on the autoroute. We were stuck in thick traffic, and she loped past us on the hard shoulder, nose in the air like a 4x4 plowing through snowdrifts, and smugly cruising by drivers strangled without chains on their tyres. I could see various chauffeurs picking up their cell phones, mouths open in disbelief, yet desperate to be the first to tell the news. Soon afterwards, those calls were rewarded by the whir of a police helicopter monitoring the bizarre phenomenon of a desert animal trotting up a European thoroughfare. The camel had now jogged way ahead of us, and the spell was broken. My driver was anxious to get off the French interstate. He took the next exit, which presented itself 20 crawling minutes later. There followed a labyrinthine detour through Lyon City to avoid the rush hour, and I reached the Hilton around 6:30 that evening. I was meeting my husband there. The occasion was a 3-day get-together of the Conference Board Europe, a group of financial officers chosen from a selection of companies. He was flying in from Paris for this working weekend, and I was flown in to play his trophy wife, or, as one of the accompanying wives later told me, a trailing wife, the new term for female corporate spouses. When Huntley walked into our suite, I gave him a big hug. "You'll never believe this," I started, calling to him as he went into the bathroom. "My taxi passed a camel on the way here." And then she caught up with us on the motorway during an awful standstill jam. He poked his head around the door, not quite believing his ears. The conclusion that years without meaningful employment had dulled my sanity showed plainly on his face. "I know it sounds impossible. I know," I protested, "but it's true." "Yes, dear," he murmured to placate his hallucinating spouse. And then, irrelevantly, I felt, he asked, "How do you know it's a she?" "She couldn't be a he with those eyes. They were huge, melting brown things surrounded by 6-foot eyelashes." He groaned and his head disappeared. A moment later, I heard the shower running. Disappointed in his lack of faith in me, I switched on the television. The news was on. The commentator began, "Ce soir, un chameau a marché la longueur de la 42 vers Lyon." Aerial footage came on screen of the camel jogging alongside the nose-to-tail voiture, presumably taken from the helicopter I'd seen earlier. The reporter explained the chameau had disparu into the darkness on reaching the city. I rushed into the bathroom and yelled at Huntley to come back and look. "My camel's on TV," I shouted. Assuming he would be curious enough to join me, I perched myself on the bed to resume watching, not wanting to miss a beat. The owner was being interviewed, a scruffy individual by the name Monsieur Joubin. As far as I could understand, he possessed 100 acres of pasture land and had been given this camel by his cousin. Said relative had brought the camel with him on returning from a long spell in Turkey, where he had bet on the camel race and won. According to local custom, he'd then been presented with the winning animal. Made to understand that giving it back amounted to a life-threatening insult, the cousin was forced to take it with him. Not having anywhere to put it, he dropped it off at Monsieur Joubin's farm. Monsieur Joubin looked morose as he explained how the camel was forever getting loose. It was permanently tied up in his field, and people were always cutting its rope. However, the animal had never before wandered so far from home, the smallest village of Satalar-Bijou near the airport. He was tired of trying to retrieve it. Did people have any idea how difficult it was to transport an 11-foot camel? Huntley had not come out from the bathroom. I was annoyed he hadn't seen any of this. Dressed for dinner, he appeared in the main room well after the news item was over. "You missed a really interesting bit on the camel," I told him reproachfully. "I suppose they filmed it overtaking your taxi, did they?" he laughed. Ignoring him, I changed into my evening wear. We were ready to leave. I flicked my white wrap in his face with what I hoped was suitable hauteur, but tucked my arm dutifully through his as befits a trophy. We glided out of the room and down one floor to the assembled group, about 30 in all. The two of us were new to these people, who came from all over Europe. Huntley had often been invited to their functions, but had never managed to squeeze in the time to attend. Consequently, he found the Camel affair useful as an icebreaker. In the coach to our restaurant, the Tête d'Oie by the Saône River, he directed the question, "Do you know what my wife claims to have seen?" to a Dutchman and his wife across the aisle, succeeded by, "She's such an animal lover, if her horses and dogs can't be with her, she'll dream some creature up." Luckily, not everyone was as cynical about my camel sighting. The others were fascinated and wondered where it was hiding. What would it find to eat in the city? A German financial officer had spent a few months in northern Africa as a student and knew a little about camels. Once settled in the restaurant, we turned to him for information. The camel in question, it seemed, was a dromedary, since it had a single hump. I irritated Huntley by announcing it was a female, together with my reason for thinking so. "Ah," said our camel expert, a Herr Reinhardt from Frankfurt, "if you are right, I believe the English for a female camel is Naga." I was intrigued. "What do they eat? What's it going to live on in Lyon?" I asked. There was a murmur of collective anxiety around the tables. "Oh, grass, Mrs. Shepherd," Herr Reinhardt assured me. "When I was looking at the plan of Lyon, I saw it as many green parks," said the wife of a French CFO. "Do not worry, the chameau, it will be all right," she said kindly. The conversation turned to other things. The ruminant had served her purpose, socially speaking, until the sweet course arrived, when the subject of my camel, as I'd begun to regard her, resurfaced. We were in the restaurant's private function room, distributed among four tables, and requiring four waiters to serve little individual pots of food. As soon as Huntley spotted what was on the menu, he couldn't resist crying out, "Hey, it's creme camel, the ship of the dessert!" There was a roar of laughter, intermingled with explanations of the puns by those with a better command of English to those with less fluency. Come time for coffee, Huntley made a big show of helping me to some sugar cubes. "One hump or two, darling?" Those closest to us burst into fresh hysterics, considerably boosted by the enormous amount of quality French wine we'd all imbibed. The joke made the rounds and mirth refilled the room. Huntley's final wisecrack was delivered on the coach back to the hotel. By this time, I was ready to kill him. Furious he didn't believe my camel story and for making a fool of me all evening, I was also genuinely concerned for the animal's well-being. He told the couple behind us in a loud voice that everyone would hear, "This imaginary animal isn't a chameleon, it's the camel of Lyon." I scowled at him while howls of laughter confirmed his reputation as the comedian of the board. A few minutes later, we poured out of our bus by the Hilton Hotel and gazed back at Lyon lying across the Rhône. Bright artificial lights, pride of the city, competed fiercely with the silent star-studded heaven above, whose moon beamed down with piercing radiance. A reversal of the David and Goliath tale came to mind, for the gigantic universe myriad point of natural light would always win the battle of brilliance against anything puny man could create. We bade each other good night, resolving to meet early for breakfast prior to a 9 a.m. guided tour of Vieux Lyon. Whilst I sat moodily in the corner, Huntley quietly got ready for bed in our executive suite. He knew he'd overstepped the line, but nevertheless, after a conciliatory bedtime kiss, couldn't resist telling me to give the camel a goodnight hug for him. Thankfully for both of us, the drink and merriment now took their toll. He fell asleep immediately, thereby avoiding certain death by irate female spouse. While he snored, the white net curtain hanging across the open French window swelled with a light breeze, like the foresail of a little yacht as it dreamily nudges its way through the rippling waters of a moon-sparkled ocean. My thoughts drifted outdoors to the Naga and Madame Soule's assurance that the chameau would be all right eating grass in some Lyon park. That proprietary feeling came over me again, and I stole out onto the balcony to think about her and calm my fury at Huntley. Our room was at the rear of the hotel, no Lyon City of Light here, and looked out over the huge, silver-hued expanse of grassland, forest, and fountains that make up the Parc de Tête d'Or. I thought about the lone camel wandering out there somewhere. Was she glad to be free? Or did she wish she were tied up, safe in Monsieur Joubin's field? The answer was right under my nose, beneath a sprawling tree, perhaps 20 yards from the hotel. A sandy, one-humped shape visible through the sparse autumn foliage of spreading branches. She must be very used to man-made lights and humans to lie so near. I had to get closer. Afraid she might at any moment get up and move out of sight, I dashed back into the room and threw a black leather jacket, the only coat I brought with me on the trip, over my long white satin evening gown. I chucked off my silver high-heeled evening sandals and dragged on dark ankle boots. For once, I remembered to grab my room key card and flew downstairs, out of the automatic back doors, into the dewy night. Cold air blasted down my lungs as my stinging eyes blinked into the darkness. Close in front of me, serene and still, lay the camel. My heart thundered loudly. She must hear it. Only then did I ask myself what I intended to do next. I knew nothing about camels. I'd only decided it was a female based on her eyelashes. Even I had to admit my reasoning wasn't faultless. I didn't know whether camels were tame or not, whether they bit or spat like llamas, maybe. In my mind, she was soft and cuddly. In reality, was it a he, and perhaps a nasty one at that? Without approaching, I would never know. My eyes had adjusted to the night, and I could make out her large moon-rimmed outline under the wide umbrella of the protective tree limbs. She was beautiful. She held her proud head high on her slender, shaggy neck. A rough rope halter hung loosely around her polar nose, and the remnants of a tether dangled. Her huge eyes were half closed as she contentedly chewed the cud. I tiptoed forward, trying not to make the slightest noise, but the dead leaves rustled under my hesitant footsteps. I held my breath. Her eyelids fluttered their long lashes towards me. Any second now, she's going to get up and run away. And the magic will be over, I thought. Yet all she did was blink and look at me with curiosity. I was mesmerized. Did I dare go closer? Would she tolerate it? Experience with my horses warned me not to appear threatening. I sat down slowly on the grass, about 15 feet away, to let her get used to me. She may be familiar with humans, but I was a new person with a different smell. She would need time to feel comfortable. Sitting quite still, I had a chance to look at her properly. Her drooping eyelashes were indeed long, and I could make out she, if it were a she, had two rows of them on each eyelid. Her breathing was slow and rhythmic, totally unperturbed. I desperately wanted to reach out and touch her, but dared not risk it yet. I wished Huntley could see this. He'd have to believe me now. But tonight he was dead to the world, and tomorrow the camel would be gone. I waited a long time. The animal would occasionally turn her regal head in my direction with an expression which seemed to ask, "Are you still there? What's so fascinating? Haven't you seen a camel before?" Then she would give an audible sigh and look away as she regurgitated more grass to chew and closed her wistful eyes. After about half an hour, I began to get cold. The thinness of my dress and lack of movement were not sustaining the warmth generated by the novelty and excitement of finding my camel. She seemed relaxed. Why not try touching her? Shivering, I stood up as quietly as I could. She barely acknowledged my shift in position. Encouraged, I edged towards her. She saw me, eyes showing interest, but no alarm. When I came within 5 feet of her, I stopped and proffered a timid hand. Her head was huge, and I presumed she had teeth to match, but the French alcohol made me brave. Stretching out her big nose, she sniffed me. She smelled as though her coat had been tumbled in the dryer with one of those clothes fresheners which promised the fragrance of just-cut hay and summer flowers. My courage rose, and I moved in closer. I stroked her forehead. To this day, I don't know what made me even think to do it, let alone carry out the thought. But the camel was so quiet that I simply hitched my expensive gown over one arm and proceeded to clamber onto her back. She didn't seem to care. Exhilarated, I nudged her with my legs, as for a horse, to ask her to get up. There was no response, even after a stronger kick. I tapped her experimentally with my foot. The reaction was immediate. With a cumbersome heave, the animal raised first its back legs, then its front ones. I did not know then whether I was being brave or stupid, and rather suspected the latter. But the feeling was intoxicating. Hugging her large neck, I nudged her shoulders with my black boots, and this time she acknowledged the aid like a horse and moved forwards. I remembered too late this was a racing camel as she lurched into a fast lope. I had a terrible time maintaining my balance. Camel legs do not move in equine sequence, one diagonal pair after the other. One whole side moves at a time, resulting in a strong swaying motion. Grateful she didn't mind my arms around her, nor my fingers digging into her long fur, I tried to relax and accustom myself to the unfamiliar and frighteningly swift movement. It was such a long way down. I should have thought about that earlier. Plus, how was I going to stop her? I couldn't reach the rope dangling from her nose without risking a fall, and I knew of no other way to halt her. These considerations were beginning to sober me up as the camel swung confidently through the park and out onto the main road, Quai Charles de Gaulle, which follows the Rhône towards the town centre. It was gone 1 o'clock in the morning by now. Luckily, we met no vehicles on our jaunt as she loped happily beside the river, taking it into her head to cross it via the Winston Churchill Bridge and turn left along the Rive Droite, down the Cours d'Herbouville, and along the Quai André Lasagne, where I wondered fleetingly whether Monsieur André had created the Italian dish as I swayed along at what felt like 80 miles per hour. It wasn't funny when my mount swerved to the right, avoiding a changing traffic light, which frightened her, through the Place Louis Pradel, past the town hall, and onto the Place des Terreaux. There, dominating the square in front of us, stood a magnificent fountain with majestic steeds plunging their way out of the pouring waters. My camel was similarly impressed, and suddenly stood still for 2 seconds, slamming my face into her furry neck. I thought the moment had come to slip off her, but as I adjusted my seat, she moved abruptly forwards again toward the rearing horses, nose in the air. She must have been thirsty, for she dropped her head down to drink. I was pitched down her neck and into the pool. The water was freezing. My joyride ended in disaster. There I was, in a satin evening dress, leather jacket and lace-up boots, in the middle of a fountain with a camel that didn't belong to me. All at once I wanted to cry. I felt stupid and cold and wet. I had no idea how I was supposed to get back to the hotel. This had to be the most idiotic thing I'd ever done in my life. I clambered out. The camel was playing with the water, taking little mouthfuls and spewing them out, I suppose in imitation of the fountain. At least she's having fun, I thought bitterly. As my feet touched dry ground, I became aware of someone watching me. This was the last thing I needed, humiliation in the form of spectators. I looked up. Of all the times to be confronted with the most perfect specimen of the male physique, tall, dark, and handsome did not even begin to describe this divine man. "Vous êtes complètement trompé, madame," he said. To tell me that I was completely soaked seemed a tad unnecessary, and I wondered whether he was deliberately rubbing salt into the wound, being someone so immaculately dressed and dry, addressing a drenched female of incongruous attire. Mustering as much dignity as I could, given my embarrassing situation, I replied, "Yes, I'm very trompé." The man laughed. "You're English." "Well spotted," I muttered between chattering teeth. "What are you doing riding a camel through Lyon at this time of night?" Thank goodness he spoke good English. I really wasn't up to struggling with French in my present circumstances. Before I could reply, not that I knew where to begin anyway, the man walked to the road flanking the square and opened the trunk of a black Mercedes. From its depths, he produced a large checked horse blanket. He carried it over to where I stood by the camel, which had started to paw at the water with its large padded foot. "You need to get out of your clothes and put this on," he said in a commanding tone. I was a married lady in the middle of a big city at night. Facts not conducive to stripping in front of an unknown man, handsome or otherwise. I opted for humour in this rather tricky situation. Contrary to appearances, I'm not Lady Godiva. I raised a mock sarcastic eyebrow. He raised a genuinely questioning one. While I floundered for alternative explanations, He fortunately gathered I was uncomfortable and took command again. If you will allow me, I shall hold this blanket round you while you change. I promise I shall not peek, he added. Smiling at his vocabulary and desperate to get warm and dry, I nodded and got out of my dripping clothes. The camel by this time had noticed little holes in the pavement in front of the fountain, dozens of them. At intervals, water would cascade out of the odd one, just for a moment, and then subside. She was fascinated, and approached one, then the other, sniffing the hole and jerking her nose back in surprise when water shot out of it. I wondered about them too as I watched her game. My hero was steadfastly looking the other way, and I didn't want to distract him from his job. I stripped and snuggled underneath the warm, enveloping blanket, trying to ignore my cold feet. I thanked him profusely, then asked about the water jets. "Ah, there are 69 of them," he replied. "One for each département of France." It was an interesting idea, and one which I would have loved to explore, but other things were more pressing, such as carrying my wet clothes and me back to the hotel, and what to do about the camel. These things were also preoccupying Monsieur. "We have to get you back home," he said. "You cannot ride the camel dressed like that." He seemed to be under the misapprehension that I rode camels back and forth every night. I had to put him right, and also enlist his help in doing something, I had no idea what, about the animal. "Monsieur," I started. "I'm so sorry. My name is Joubin, Jacques Joubin." "Hang on," I thought. "Isn't that the name of the camel owner I saw on television? Certainly didn't look or sound like this refined man. Might be a common name like Smith or Jones in English, but I had to ask. Are you by any chance related to the Monsieur Joubin who's lost this camel?" "So this is not your chameau?" he asked. The man was too self-possessed for words. What kind of world did he move in that he didn't bat an eyelid when women came roaring around the corner on camels and nosedived into fountains? Not that I, on reflection, was complaining he'd not made a big humiliating deal out of it, but it was unusual. "No, I found her in the park by the Hilton where I'm staying." "So this must be Minouche. My cousin's camels are got loose this morning." "So she is a girl," I cried triumphantly. "Oh, very much so," my companion assured me. "She is a sweetheart, as you would say. I did wonder whether it was her, but she looked so confident up there that I thought there must be two camels in Lyon." "Until I fell off," I said dejectedly. "Do you know how to get her back to your cousin?" "I'm afraid the question is whether he wants her back. He is very, fed up with her. I have some land back home and could put her there, I suppose." I was in awe of this man's sang-froid. Did absolutely no situation baffle him? "How will you get her there?" Monsieur Joubin smiled and put his forefinger to his nose in a conspiratorial gesture as he pulled out a cell phone from inside his dark silk jacket pocket and dialed a number. "Salut, Georges. J'ai trouvé la chamelle de mon cousin ici à la place de Terreau. Oui. Il faut la mener chez moi. D'accord. Je vais la mettre à la tâche, près de la fontaine. The head groom will come and fetch her in the open trailer. In the meantime, I shall tie her up by the fountain. Could you go over and hold her rope?" As I lifted my hand from under the rug to do as I was bid, we both realized I was going to reveal the bits of me he'd have been at such pains not to look at if I didn't use both hands to keep the blanket round me. We laughed. "Don't worry, the camel is happy playing with the water. I will fetch the rope." I wandered over to Minouche and stood by her. Monsieur Joubin went back to his car's trunk and came back with a horse lead and an upmarket shopping bag with YSL written conspicuously on it. He knotted the end of his and the camel's dangling ropes together and gently led her to a railing behind the fountain. "She should be fine here. My groom will only be 10 minutes or so. We must get you back to your hotel." He scooped my wet clothes into the plastic bag and turned diplomatically away so I could take farewell of my nocturnal mount. I rubbed Minouche's nose, hitching the rug up as decently as I could, and kissed her goodbye. "And there's that hug from Huntley," I added. He'd be glad to know I'd carried out his wishes. She looked so forlorn, tied up again. I walked with my French friend back to his car. The trip back to the Hilton wasn't very long. He asked my name, and I quizzed him about his Turkish escapade and winning Minouche, as well as the obvious fact that he, like myself, kept horses. It transpired that he lived in a chateau near Monsieur Joubert's home village. He had not inherited it at the time of the camel transfer to his less well-off cousin, and felt much to blame for her current status. His wife and two children declared her to be a sweetheart because the animal was always so pleased to be visited by them in her lonely field. He even suspected his oldest daughter of having cut her loose. "What will you do with Minouche?" I asked. I too felt responsible for her now I'd ridden her away from her park refuge and caused her to be tied up once more. "What do you suggest I do with her?" came the question back. Ideas back and forth between us took up the rest of the short trip. As Monsieur drew up by the hotel, he offered to see me to my room. I was most appreciative, as I had been dreading the embarrassment of the hotel staff gawping at me barefoot in my outré outfit. He would lend me some respectability. To add to my troubles, my damp keycard was now useless, and Monsieur Joubin was kind enough to go to the front desk and get it replaced. This always means changing the code of the door, and Huntley was not going to be pleased about his key not working anymore. But it would lend credence to my camel story. I asked my rescuer to wait a moment as I went into the room, carrying the bag with my clothes, and put on the regulation white hotel dressing gown before opening the door and returning his rug. "I would like to know your final plans for Minouche," I said. "May I call you?" "Certainly," he replied. "Here's my card." "Thank you so much for all you've done." "It's made a very interesting evening for me," he bowed and left. I crashed into bed. It was now 3 o'clock. I was supposed to go on that beastly tour of the city in a few hours. I would have to beg off. I drifted into sleep and a dream about riding Minouche in a camel race that took place in Newmarket over hurdles, which grew higher and wider as we approached them. Huntley shook me at 7 o'clock. "Come on, sleepyhead. We've got to meet the others for breakfast. Tour of Vieux-Lyon, remember?" I groaned. "Would you mind if I didn't go?" "Why? You were keen enough last night." "Well, I had a bit of an adventure." And I told him about it, with a predictable result. He didn't believe a word. "Haven't I been paying you enough attention lately? Is that why you're telling stories, to draw notice to yourself?" "Huntley, why won't you believe me? Every word is true. Ring Monsieur Joubin if you like. He'll tell you." "I'm not going to ring someone whose card you've acquired by dubious means and embarrass myself by asking him if he was with you and a camel last night." "Fine, but you can do your tour by yourself. I'm not going." "Suit yourself," he snapped. And that was the last I saw of him all day. After I'd calmed down, I rang Monsieur Joubin. It was as much to reassure myself it had happened as to discover the fate of Minouche, the Naga. We had a good conversation which fortified me against my husband's incredulity. We've been back in England for a week now. The doorbell rang this Saturday morning and Huntley opened it to find a Frenchman standing there. "Good morning, Monsieur Shepherd. We have delivered your camel." For the last time, Huntley turned to me in disbelief. I smiled smugly. "I told you I saw a camel." The end.